and welcome to the CAAB podcast. Today, we're taking a detailed look at nature markets, a topic that has dominated farming and environmental headlines in recent years. This developing area has the potential to both generate an income for land managers, to mitigate the impact of climate change, and improve our natural environment. But as with any embryonic market, it's a complex area. So Richard Sanders, Technical and Policy Advisor at the CAAB, is here with me to offer a bit of clarity. So Richard, could you give us a bit of background to where we are now?
Thanks very much, Olivia, and good to be back on the podcast with you. Information on how nature markets could work in the UK has been released in various announcements in recent years. As you've mentioned, it's gathering a bit of attention. We've had the 25-year environment plan, Dasgupta report, in England, the payment principles for the environmental land management schemes, in Scotland, principles for investing in natural capital, and then things such as biodiversity net gain, that developing market in England, carbon offsetting and nutrient neutrality as well. And all of those have been developed and are starting to be implemented. However, the Nature Markets Framework, a recent publication that was put out by DEFRA at the end of March, was one of the first government documents to bring much of this together. The paper focuses on England, but it has important implications for the UK as a whole. It contains some announcements on what we can expect in the future, but also, and maybe more usefully, it sets out in one place guidance on some key principles and expectations for markets in the UK. The publication of the framework provides the excuse for us today to discuss nature markets more widely. I want to focus more on the background and the theory to the markets rather than particular practical features. So some of this may be a bit general for those interested in the nitty-gritty of selling environmental goods. That said, we regularly publish updates on the website on those markets and developing areas, and so that might be of interest to members and rural businesses who want to know a bit more detail.
So what is the context? What's driving the need to develop these markets?
So the last few decades have seen an increasing recognition of the need to protect and restore the environment. Primarily, this is concerned climate change and greenhouse gas emissions, and that's where the majority of the reporting is on this. But more recently, there's also been a growing focus on biodiversity and the natural environment more widely. The effects of climate change have also brought a practical focus to questions of water and soil management. The growing consensus has led to a number of national and international targets and agreements. Internationally, we have the agreements of the climate and biodiversity COPs, COP15, most recently for biodiversity. So all of this then feeds in and relates to the national picture as well, where there are various pieces of legislation driving the change. In England, there's the Climate Change Act and the Environment Act. In Northern Ireland, there's also a Climate Change Act. And Scotland has legislated for climate targets in its Climate Change Act as well. There are also various action plans and targets for biodiversity in each of the devolved administrations. In Wales, their Environment Act sets out targets for decarbonisation. There are also industry initiatives to support investment in nature, things like the Task Force on Climate-Related Financial Disclosure, often referred to as the TCFD, and the more recent but related Task Force on Nature-Related Financial Disclosure, called the TNFD. These are two notable initiatives that aim to get large companies to recognise their impacts on the climate and on biodiversity. So we have this twin-track approach creating the need for investment, the meeting of international and national targets, and the need to mitigate and adapt to a changing climate. So we have a twin-track approach creating the need for investment, the meeting of international targets and national targets on the one hand, and the need to mitigate and adapt to climate change on the other. These, of course, are related and feed into one another. All of this drives that need for investment, for financing. So developing nature markets create that opportunity for companies and investors to direct their funds and their investments to projects that will support the goals and ambitions that are set out in the legislation, in the targets and in the frameworks. The UK government has a goal of seeing £500 million of private investment in nature each year by 2027, rising to a figure of £1 billion each year by 2030. A report by the Green Finance Institute estimated that the UK needed around £56 billion, as a central estimate, in private investment in order to achieve the set out nature targets of the policies and the frameworks and the legislation that I mentioned above. So there's growing activity in this area. In England, there's the Green Finance Strategy and the Nature Markets Framework, which we're going to touch on a bit more today. Only last week, the Scottish Government also published a paper titled Mobilising Private Investment in Natural Capital. And there's also those numerous private sector initiatives that people might hear about.
So what do you mean when you're talking about nature markets? Can you set out the key concepts?
So there's a bit of a muddle with various terms and definitions in much of the discussion about nature markets. And often these things get talked about with a range of labels, all meaning something slightly similar, but varying depending on the context. So you might hear about natural capital or ecosystem services, or maybe public goods or nature-based solutions. And often this comes in connection with other terms like externalities or the polluter pays principle. Going back to some of the fundamentals of environmental economics, the sort of field that we're looking at here, we should remember the key definitions. So first, natural capital. Natural capital is the stock of natural assets, things like trees, water, and soils. The resilience of these stocks is then underpinned by biodiversity. Flowing from these stocks come ecosystem services, that is, the things that the stocks provide. So we have things like timber and food, but also the less tangible flows like carbon sequestration and water filtration. Sometimes, and using those terms that I mentioned above, you might hear this discussed as stocks and flows. It's those ecosystem services, underpinned and provided by the natural capital, that then can provide benefits to society. So this is a slightly different way at looking at the natural environment and of accounting for its features. While this may feel like a very new approach, I just want to highlight quickly the similarities with the more traditional or the more familiar work of members of the CAAV. I mentioned soil above as a natural capital, and then food provision as an ecosystem service. So rural valuers are already heavily involved with natural capital. The very foundational activities of our profession and of the membership, such as tenant right or livestock valuation, recognise the value of some particular elements of natural capital to rural businesses. I'm going to take this moment to plug a publication on our website for members of the CAAV, a note on reading a natural capital report. This covers the definitions set out briefly above, and it looks in more detail at the concepts and assessing natural capital. If you search for reading a natural capital report on our website, this should throw up the paper. Alternatively, do get in touch with me and I can send across a copy. Coming back to the Nature Markets Framework paper, that document published by government in March, that defines nature markets as a mechanism for private investment in nature through the sale of units of ecosystem services, which are delivered by nature restoration projects or improvements to land or coastal management. So here we've got some of those key concepts mentioned above. Within that definition of nature markets, we then have this for ecosystem services. Those are the benefits delivered by nature, for example, carbon sequestration, biodiversity, water quality improvement, and flood mitigation. So I think when we're talking about government policy, it's quite useful to stick to the definitions set out by government as well. And while we're going to be talking about private markets today, focusing on that sale of units, it's also important not to lose sight of the interactions with government schemes and funding. And while we're going to be talking primarily about private markets here and getting private investment flowing into nature restoration, it's important not to lose sight of the interactions with government and public schemes and other sources of funding.
So what sort of markets and trades are we talking about here then?
So the definition that I used above, the one that's given in the framework, that's quite tight. Nature markets for this are the sale of units of ecosystem services. So a kilogram of carbon stored, a unit of biodiversity, a kilogram of nutrient not entering a watercourse, and so on. However, for today, I want to think a little wider as well, so we can go beyond the trade of environmental credits, even if this is the most visible element of these markets. Instead, we can start to think about the many ways in which the environment is acknowledged within a market. So this could be carbon credits, that trade of units for carbon sequestration, or it could be nature or sustainability requirements more broadly, perhaps those in supply contracts or conditions on loan finance. It's very early days for a lot of the markets that we're going to talk about today. Even carbon, which is probably the most development of the nature markets in the UK, is still emerging as a fully formed market. So listeners should bear this in mind. There's lots of uncertainty and change and plenty of caveats in all the examples that I'm going to give. Then I think it can be useful to distinguish between two types of markets. We'll call them compliance or regulatory markets, and also those that we can call voluntary markets. Looking first at compliance markets, there are rules and regulations that mean companies and individuals need to think about or offset their impact on nature. Primarily, it's going to be the government setting the rules. For voluntary markets, businesses or individuals recognize the value in improving or protecting nature. So maybe they think that doing so has a moral benefit. It's the right thing to do. Or they see that it will reduce their exposure to risk or save them money. We can think about flooding. Maybe it's more cost effective to plant trees and rewiggle certain rivers than it is to build hard flood defenses or repair the damage of frequent flooding. Carbon gives an example of where a certain element of nature is in both compliance and voluntary markets. And there are other points of overlap as well. Industry, for example, could make rules for its own practice. So this starts to look similar to compliance markets, but I think for clarity, I'd like to include them under the voluntary label, given that these rules are going to be self-imposed. And of course, there's also the possibility of some movement of markets from the voluntary, so they start out being voluntary markets with voluntary rules, self-imposed, to then being picked up by regulators and turned into compliance markets later on.
Could you give some examples of these markets and what each recognises?
So for this, I think it'd be good to go back to the definition given in the nature markets framework of those nature markets and think about some of the examples there and how they can be used to make this clearer. There we had carbon, biodiversity, water quality and flood mitigation. So let's go back to carbon to start. There are two main carbon markets in the UK. The UK emissions trading scheme, a compliance market for emissions, and the voluntary carbon market. The emissions trading scheme is a cap and trade system for the largest polluters. So regulators set a maximum limit of the amount of carbon that can be emitted by certain sectors of the economy, a limit that declines over time. And the idea then is that it drives down total emissions. Participants in the market receive free allowances to emit carbon under that limit, or they can purchase allowances in an auction or on the secondary market. Where businesses emit less than the number of permits that they hold, they can then trade those permits with other market participants. This incentivizes improvements and also innovation. I'm going to benefit if I can be more efficient with my emissions. So this is a good example of a compliance or regulatory market. Certain sectors have to comply, and the cost of carbon, that price of emitting, is influenced by the rules of the market. It's notable just briefly to mention that there's no offsetting allowed within the UK ETS. So companies can't be buying carbon credits from someone planting trees, for example, in order to increase that total number of emissions permits in the scheme. Those in the rural sector will probably be more familiar with the voluntary carbon market. Here, there's no obligation to recognise carbon emissions, as with the UK ETS. However, companies can purchase carbon credits in order to make claims about their own sustainability. They may have targets to meet that have been set internally, driven by climate goals, or some of the offsetting may be of value for marketing or human resources reasons. Some companies find that they can trade at a premium where they're demonstrating their sustainability. Others may find it easier to recruit and retain the right people when they've got those green credentials and they've got those schemes going on as well. Land managers in this voluntary market can generate carbon credits through actions such as planting trees, and therefore sequestering or promising to sequester carbon, or by restoring peatlands and avoiding the carbon emitted when those peatlands are degraded. Aside from credits and that sort of trade of carbon credits that we might be most familiar with, carbon considerations are also starting to work their way into supply contracts. For example, some supermarkets and dairy processors are asking their suppliers to assess their environmental impact and may even be paying a premium for their produce where they're taking steps to address those emissions and they can demonstrate those reductions over time. So biodiversity is the next example given in that nature markets framework definition. That's a market that's developing in England, where we are to have biodiversity net gain from the end of this year. Those who want to learn more about BNG can listen to the introductory podcast that's available on our website. Under BNG, developers will have to deliver an uplift in biodiversity values at the completion of the development. The rules and methods of measurement are set out in regulations. Wales is currently consulting on strengthening provisions for biodiversity and planning policy, and Scotland is also targeting biodiversity improvements. In these regions, the market may not work the same, but developers will have to consider their impact on nature to a greater extent. In that way, impacts on biodiversity are going to be priced into the cost of development, Water quality has also been a market where there's been a growing focus over recent years. There are elements of this market that are voluntary and some that are part of compliance markets. On the more voluntary side, some water companies recognize the value in investing in nature in water catchments in order to reduce purification and water management costs later on. On the compliance side, nutrient neutrality has emerged in England over the past year. Under those nutrient neutrality requirements, developers must address the impact of pollutants like nitrates or phosphates on designated protected habitats. They can do this by investing in water treatment at the development site or by paying land managers in the same catchment to reduce their pollution accordingly. And then we generate those nutrient credits and those units that can be sold in the market. Flood mitigation is similar. You know, some are seeing the values in holding water higher up the catchment, slowing the flow as it's cooled, and then reducing the damage later on. The impact of flooding is also recognized in insurance contracts as part of risk. So hopefully, by thinking about these practical examples, we can start to understand how the emerging markets for nature work, how they're set up, what they're focused on, and what the characteristics of each are.
So what is needed to make these markets work well and to deliver the intended environmental outcomes?
So nature markets need what all markets need. They need clarity, certainty, and trust. So one key element here is measurement, reporting, and verification, often known by the acronym MRV. We need to know firstly what impact we are having on the environment so that it can be addressed. We need to report regularly and accurately on our actions to ensure that there's going to be transparency and to keep on track to meet any ambitions. And finally, our actions need to be verified independently. Are we undertaking the promised activities? Are they having the desired impact? So have we really planted the trees? Are they growing well? If so, how much carbon are they really storing away? We also need to think about the standards and codes that govern each market. These could be at a higher level, so overarching principles that all markets should be meeting. Or they could relate to the practical setup of the market, how things should be counted, how things should be verified, how credits can be generated and traded. So often you hear standard used for those higher level rules and code used for the detail, you know, those smaller granular things that I mentioned a minute ago, but they're often used interchangeably as well. Again, some examples might be useful here. For the voluntary carbon market in the UK, the main codes are the Woodland Carbon Code and the Peatland Code. There is also the Wilder Carbon Standard and the newly established Hedgerow Carbon Code. There are also international carbon standards that set higher level principles, things like the Verra Carbon Standard and the Gold Standard. We're discussing relatively new concepts here, but it's also useful to look for similarities with what we know well. You know, think about the property market, the various regulations that make it flow and have value. The property market in the UK is one of the most valuable in the world because it has clear regulations to support both buyers and sellers. Or think about food markets, a topic that's been in the farming press a bit recently. Trust along the supply chain supports value and gives certainty. Where that trust is damaged, that can then have knock-on effects.
Now, additionality is central to these standards. Can you discuss that a little bit?
Yes, a key concept for those emerging markets, one of those higher-level concepts that governs things more broadly. Let's go back to the nature markets framework and the definitions in there. So additionality is defined there as credits or units issued in nature markets must be based on new environmental improvements verified against an appropriate baseline. So we're going above and beyond what we're already required to do and what's already there in the first place. There are several ways to test whether an action will be additional. The main tests discussed in the framework are legal additionality and financial additionality. Legal additionality looks at our existing legal or rules-based obligations and sets the baseline from there. For example, if we're going to be required to plant trees, perhaps we have a restocking order or there's an existing planning condition, then we can't claim that the carbon sequestered by those trees is then additional. We're obliged to undertake the action already. However, when we start thinking about that legal additionality, there's going to be some flexibility. We're concerned here with the rules of the scheme. So, if the rules say that something can be considered additional, then we can then start counting it for more than one thing. A good example of this is biodiversity net gain and nutrient neutrality, two markets I mentioned earlier. There are some complexities here, but essentially, The rules of both schemes allow for the same action, say planting woodland, to contribute to meeting the obligations of both the schemes. So that's legal additionality. When we're thinking about financial additionality, the question that we need to ask is this: does the activity make economic sense without the funding from selling those ecosystem services? Financial additionality tests, as defined in the Nature Markets framework, assess whether projects would have been viable investments without the income from selling ecosystem service market credits, and only allow credits to be issued where this income is found to be make or break for the project. For example, if the best economic decision for me as a land manager is to plant trees on my land for timber, so that's going to be more profitable than other uses, and there's going to be the possibility that I might gain against my costs, against my risk, then I can't really say that I need to sell the carbon credits from that woodland in order to justify the project. A financial additionality test, sort of along these lines, but with particularities, is used in the UK Woodland Carbon Code. So there's a bit of debate on how to assess financial additionality. You know, what are those questions? What are we baselining against? And there are some limits to this approach as well. And in fact, in the Nature Markets framework, the government identified a review of the principle of this financial additionality principle as a piece for future work.
With that in mind, how can people operate in more than one market? Is this even possible?
So this brings us on to the concepts of stacking and bundling. In summary, stacking is where we sell more than one ecosystem service from a particular project, and we sell it as a distinct service. So going back to those foundational definitions, those ecosystem services are the things that arise out of the natural capital that may bring benefits for society. You know, so if we're stacking, we're picking out those ecosystem services individually, and we're selling them as distinct services. So we could sell more than one service to the same person, or we could sell them to different people. But what's important here, if we're stacking, is that we're accounting for them individually. An example might be useful here again. Planting a woodland is going to have several environmental benefits. So it's going to sequester carbon, it improves biodiversity, it improves water management, and so on. So if we're stacking these benefits, we can sell each individually. Someone may need to offset their biodiversity impact. Either they or another person may also be looking to offset their carbon or their nutrient impacts. You know, there are markets where you might need to do biodiversity net gain and also meet nutrient neutrality requirements. If stacking is allowed, the landowner is going to be able to sell those separate benefits from the same woodland to meet those various needs. Now, whether we can stack credits or benefits and sell them in different directions like this depends on a few things. It depends on the rules of the schemes in question. And it also depends on some very careful accounting of what's been delivered. Currently, there's only very limited ability to stack environmental benefits from one activity, and the government are reviewing how more can be achieved. I've mentioned earlier and just now how the same change can contribute to both biodiversity net gain and nutrient neutrality schemes. Clearly, there's a balance that's going to need to be struck here. Stacking credits like this can mean more investment, and more income is achieved by the farmer or the land manager. And that's something that's going to be valuable as basic payment and as, you know, farm support changes and basic payment declines, and people are looking to make a profit and to replace that money that was coming in. On the other hand, stacking credits like this could mean that investment is not used efficiently, and we could be left in a position where environmental impacts are not fully addressed. Bundling is related to stacking, but it's a slightly different concept. When ecosystem services are bundled, the benefits are rolled into one package, and then that's sold to the same buyer, to one purchaser. For example, maybe a project could generate a wetland credit, and that's going to include the carbon, water quality, biodiversity benefits, and so on. So bundling has fewer risks than stacking from an environmental point of view, but there's still going to be challenges here. Firstly, the seller needs to have everything lined up and rolled into one deal. You know, we've got that one point of sale, that one unit that's carrying all of these benefits. Is the buyer going to recognize the value of each ecosystem service that's being created? You know, what if some markets exist, carbon, biodiversity, but other markets don't, you know, water quality and so on. In the market, there's various ways in which we're starting to see bundling in action. So the Wilder Carbon Standard, that's a good example. It's a carbon credit that I mentioned earlier, and those generating those credits need to follow strict guidelines on the environmental quality of that unit. So the idea is that in recognizing biodiversity values as well, those carbon credits are going to sell as a premium. You know, they're carbon plus biodiversity.
So how can farmers and land managers benefit from these new income streams? And how does it all interact with existing agricultural businesses?
So as I said at the start, and I've sort of tried to caveat myself all the way through, many of these markets are still in the process of developing. You know, those interested need to be conscious of the risks to entering the market early. I looked at this in more detail, you know, and the particularities of that market in the podcast on biodiversity net gain. That said, there may be opportunities for land managers now and in the future. I can't go over too much detail here, but let's look at a few points for consideration. The most important thing is to go back to the fundamentals of any deal or agreement. You know, what are the terms and what is the price? Right terms, right price, and then there may be an incentive to entering the market and to doing some trades. You know, clearly each answer here is going to be different depending on the context, and everything needs to be looked at individually. Baselining and assessing the land is going to be key. What can we deliver from the farm or the estate from the land in question? What are the opportunities? What are the risks? And then there are some secondary questions here to that baselining. Which measurements should I be taking? Which markets am I focusing on? You know, what am I putting into the scope of this assessment? I'd point members back again to that natural capital publication that I mentioned earlier, which is available on the website. I think one key element here is not to get distracted primarily and to focus in too tightly on these markets. You know, but rather we should be asking, how might the ecosystem service markets complement existing business operations or support a plan to change? And they're not necessarily a stark alternative. They could be complementary in something that comes alongside. For example, if we want to move away anyway from intensive agriculture, you know, maybe those profit margins are not there once BPS is gone. You know, maybe there's an incentive to change the system. Are there then going to be opportunities to create some environmental benefit from extensive agriculture, from the change that we want to make already? If we want to plant trees in any case, there may be amenity or sporting reasons, then maybe some carbon income will be a nice sweetener to that. So related to this, there's the need to think strategically about the direction of the business, you know, and what capacity it has for environmental improvements in the long run. For example, there's a lot of discussion around carbon at the moment. You know, you can read lots of commentary and see lots of examples of people doing certain trades or warning against certain trades. I think the key thing to remember here, that agriculture has its own targets for net zero, and so too do the processors and retailers who are going to be purchasing that agricultural produce from the farmer or land manager. So if the intention is to continue farming, continue that agricultural business, then it may be advisable to hold on to the carbon sequestration potential of the land. If it's been sold away, if trees have been planted and those units have been sold, then we cannot count that carbon sequestered for our own business purposes or to meet those contractual conditions that may start to become necessary going forward. And finally, we shouldn't overlook government agreements in all of this as well. It could be that private buyers of ecosystem services are in fact more exacting than the government will be in their schemes. So we can think countryside stewardship historically has been 5 years. How long are the obligations for biodiversity net gain, for nutrient neutrality, for carbon sequestration? You know, they could be a lot longer, the penalties could be much greater. Things should all be weighed on their merits. So I think for all the commentary and all the discussion and everything I've just said above, we should keep right terms, right price as a bit of a mantra in all of this.
With that context, let's finish off by returning to the nature markets framework. What is the government planning to do and how do you see this developing?
There's a central role for government to play in all of this. You know, most blatantly, they can create these nature markets, as is the case with biodiversity net gain. You know, they can put regulations in place that drive that investment into nature. In the nature markets framework, and coming back to that document that kicked off all of this discussion, the government has identified some future action for them to take to provide certainty to markets and support their development. This includes several forthcoming consultations on supporting the integrity of those developing markets. It includes looking closely at rules around stacking and additionality, including a review of the financial additionality test. The British Standards Institute has been appointed to expedite a pipeline of investment standards for nature markets, as it's called in the framework. This is to include broader governing principles and standards, as well as more targeted standards for particular ecosystem services. These standards then are going to help to bring certainty and clarity to the markets, hopefully unlocking more of that investment. The government's going to continue to encourage, and maybe in some cases pressure, larger companies and businesses to report on and address their impacts on nature. This pressure from the top can then lead to greater investment on the land. DEFRA will set out in 2024 how they're going to support farmers to undertake carbon audits on their land. So this is really going to help land managers and farmers to understand their baseline position and then either tackle their own emissions or to consider entering into carbon markets with that knowledge and with those baselines in place. The government's also going to continue to use public money to invest in the development of nature markets. The intention is to support the early stages, reducing some of those risks, and then to crowd in private finance, as it's called. They've been doing this already with things like the Natural Environment Investment Readiness Fund. Many listeners may have heard of that scheme. And then also Landscape Recovery, which has in it some requirements for private finance to come along with the public funding as well. So it's really going to be a busy few years. There's going to be a lot to learn and new things to pick up and get familiar with. There may be many new opportunities and many new risks as well. And farmers and their advisors will need to be more responsive and flexible to the changing landscape and to looking about and see what's going on nationally, but also locally as well. As always, the CAAV will continue to support its members through briefings, events, and of course, through podcasts as well.
Thank you so much, Richard. There's clearly a lot still to come in the pipeline and some significant opportunities to be realised. Professional advisors are going to be key in helping farmers to navigate these emerging markets. And the work that you're doing at the CAAV to keep members updated will be integral to that. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks very much, Livia.
And there we are. We've reached the end of yet another episode of the CAAV podcast. If you want to keep up to date with all future episodes, or indeed catch up on previous ones, please head to our website, or you can subscribe for free on whatever platform you use. Also, if you have any feedback or ideas for future episodes, please get in touch by emailing us on enquire@caav.org.uk. That's it for today, so until the next time, thank you very much for listening. Bye for now.